She ran her hands under the water, then brought them to her face. She drew a series of rapid breaths, hiding her face, and made a choking sound. She let her shoulders heave a little. "Are you crying?" he asked. She heard his chair slide back. "Why the hell are you crying?" She choked out the words, doing her best to make them sound broken. "I don't know what to do anymore. I don't know what you want. I know how big this case is and how important it is and how much pressure you're under." She choked off the final words, sensing his approach. When she felt him touch her, she shuddered. "Hey, it's okay," he said, grudgingly. "You don't have to cry." She turned toward him, squeezing her eyes shut, putting her face against his chest. "I just want to make you happy," she stammered. She wiped her wet face on his shirt. "We'll figure it out, okay? We'll have a nice weekend, I promise, to make up for last night." She put her arms around him, pulling him close, sniffling. She drew another rasping inhale. "I'm really sorry. I know you didn't need that today, me getting all blubbery for nothing. You've got so much on your plate already."
"I can handle it," he said.
He tilted his head and she leaned up to kiss him, her eyes still shut. When she pulled back, she wiped her face with her fingers and pulled close to him again. As he pressed against her, she could feel him getting excited. She knew how her vulnerability turned him on.
"We've got a little time before I have to head into work," he said.
"I should clean the kitchen first."
"You can do it later," he said.
Minutes later, with Kevin moving atop her, she made the sounds he wanted while staring out the window of the bedroom and thinking of other things. She had learned to hate winter, with the endless cold and a yard half buried in snow, because she couldn't go outside. Kevin didn't like her to walk around the neighborhood, but he let her garden in the backyard because of the privacy fence. In the spring, she always planted flowers in pots and vegetables in a small plot near the back of the garage, where the sun was full and strong, unshaded by the maple trees. In the fall, she would pull on a sweater and read books from the library as fallen leaves, brown and crinkly, drifted around the yard. But winter made her life a prison, cold and gray and gloomy. Misery. Most days were spent without setting foot outside the door because she never knew when Kevin would show up unexpectedly. She knew the names of a single neighbor, the Feldmans, who lived across the street. In her first year of marriage, Kevin rarely hit her, and sometimes she went for walks without him. The Feldmans, an older couple, liked to work in their garden, and in the first year she'd lived here, she often stopped to talk to them for a while. Kevin gradually tried to put an end to those friendly visits. Now she saw the Feldmans only when she knew Kevin was busy at work, when she knew he couldn't call. She would make sure no other neighbors were watching before darting across the street to their front door. She felt like a spy when she visited with them. They showed her photos of their daughters growing up. One had died, and the other had moved away, and she had the sense that they were as lonely as she was. In the summer, she made them blueberry pies and would spend the rest of the afternoon mopping up the flour in the kitchen so Kevin wouldn't know. After Kevin went to work, she cleaned the windows and put fresh sheets on the bed. She vacuumed, dusted, and cleaned the kitchen. As she worked, she practiced lowering her voice so she could sound like a man. She tried not to think about the cell phone she had charged overnight and put under the sink. Even though she knew that she might never get a better chance, she was terrified because there was still so much that could go wrong. She made Kevin breakfast on Monday morning, just as she always did. 4 slices of bacon, eggs over medium, and 2 pieces of toast. He was grumpy and distracted, and he read the paper without saying much to her. When he was about to leave, he put a coat on over his suit, and she told him she was going to hop into the shower.
"Must be nice," he grunted, "to wake up every day knowing you can do whatever the hell you want to do, whenever you want to do it."
"Is there anything special you want for dinner?" she asked, pretending not to have heard him. He thought about it.
Lasagna and garlic bread. And a salad, he said.
When he left, she stood at the window, watching as his car reached the corner. As soon as he turned, she walked to the phone, dizzy at the thought of what was to come next. When she called the phone company, she was directed to customer service. 5 minutes passed, then six. It would take Kevin 20 minutes to get to work, and no doubt he would call as soon as he arrived. She still had time. Finally, a rep got on the line and asked her name and the billing address, and for purposes of identification, Kevin's mother's maiden name. The account was in Kevin's name, and she spoke in a low voice as she recited the information, in the voice she'd been practicing. She didn't sound like Kevin, maybe not even masculine, but the representative was harried and didn't notice. "Is it possible to get call forwarding on my line?" she asked.
"It's an extra charge, but with that you also get call waiting and voicemail. It's only..."
"That's fine. But is it possible to have it turned on today?"
"Yes,"
the representative said. She heard him beginning to type. It was a long time before he spoke again. He told her the extra charge would show up on the next bill, which would be sent out next week, but that it would still reflect the full monthly amount, even though she activated the service today. She told him it was fine. He took some more information and then told her it was done and that she would be able to use the service right away. She hung up and glanced at the clock. The whole transaction had taken 18 minutes. Kevin called from the precinct 3 minutes later. As soon as she got off the phone with Kevin, she called Super Shuttle, a van service that transported people to the airport and bus station. She made a reservation for the following day. Then, after retrieving the cell phone, she finally activated it. She called a local movie theater, one that had a recording, to make sure it worked. Next, she activated the landline's call forwarding service, sending incoming calls to the number of the movie theater. As a test, she dialed the home number from her cell phone. Her heart was pounding as the landline rang. On the second ring, the ring cut off, and she heard the recording from the movie theater. Something broke free inside her, and her hands were shaking as she powered off the cell phone and replaced it in the box of SOS pads. She reset the landline. Kevin called again, 40 minutes later. She spent the rest of the afternoon in a daze, working steadily to keep from worrying. She ironed two of his shirts and brought the suit bag and suitcase in from the garage. She set out clean socks and she polished his other pair of black shoes. She ran the lint brush over his suit, the black one he wore to court, and laid out three ties. She scrubbed the bathroom until the floor was shiny and scrubbed the baseboards with vinegar. She dusted every item in the china cabinet and then started preparing the lasagna. She boiled the pasta and made a meat sauce and layered all of it with cheese. She brushed 4 pieces of sourdough bread with butter, garlic, and oregano and diced everything she needed for the salad. She showered and dressed sexy, and at 5 o'clock, she put the lasagna in the oven. When he got home, dinner was ready. He ate the lasagna and talked about his day. When he asked for a second serving, she rose from the table and brought it to him. After dinner, he drank vodka as they watched reruns of Seinfeld and The King of Queens. Afterward, the Celtics were playing the Timberwolves, and she sat beside him, her head on his shoulder, watching the game. He fell asleep in front of the television, and she wandered to the bedroom. She lay in bed, staring at the ceiling, until he finally woke and staggered in, flopping onto the mattress. He fell asleep immediately, one arm draped over her, and his snores sounded like a warning. She made him breakfast on Tuesday morning. He packed his clothes and toiletries and was finally ready to head to Marlboro. He loaded his things into the car, then went back to the front door where she was standing. He kissed her.
"I'll be home tomorrow night," he said.
"I'll miss you," she said, leaning into him, putting her arms around his neck.
"I should be home around 8.
"I'll make you something that I can reheat when you get home," she said. "How about chili?"
"I'll probably eat on the way home."
"Are you sure? Do you really want to eat fast food? It's so bad for you.
We'll see, he said.
I'll make it anyway, she said, just in case. He kissed her as she leaned into him.
I'll call you, he said,
his hands drifting downward, caressing her. I know, she answered. In the bathroom, she took off her clothes and set them on the toilet, then rolled up the rug. She'd placed a garbage bag in the sink, and naked, she stared at herself in the mirror. She fingered the bruises on her ribs and on her wrist. All of her ribs stood out, and dark circles beneath her eyes gave her face a hollowed-out look. She was engulfed by a wave of fury mixed with sadness as she imagined the way he'd call for her when he walked through the house upon his return. He'd call her name and walk to the kitchen. He'd look for her in the bedroom. He'd check the garage and the back porch and the cellar.
Where are you? He'd call out. What's for dinner?
With the scissors, she began to chop savagely at her hair. 4 inches of blonde hair fell onto the garbage bag. She seized another chunk, using her fingers to pull it tight, telling herself to measure, and snipped. Her chest felt constricted and tight. I hate you, she hissed, her voice trembling. Degraded me all the time? She lopped off more hair, her eyes flooding with rage-fueled tears. Hit me because I had to go shopping? More hair gone. She tried to slow down, even out the ends. Made me steal money from your wallet and kicked me because you're drunk? She was shaking now, her hands unsteady. Uneven lengths of hair collected at her feet. Made me hide from you? Hit me so hard that I vomit? She snapped the scissors. I loved you, she sobbed. You promised me you'd never hit me again, and I believed you. I wanted to believe you. She cut and cried, and when her hair was all the same length, she pulled out the hair dye from its hiding place behind the sink. Dark brown. Then she got in the shower and wet her hair. She tilted the bottle and began massaging the dye into her hair. She stood at the mirror and sobbed uncontrollably while it set. When it was done, she climbed into the shower again and rinsed it out. She shampooed and conditioned and stood before the mirror. Carefully, she applied mascara to her eyebrows, darkening them. She added bronzer to her skin, darkening it. She dressed in jeans and a sweater and stared at herself. A dark, short-haired stranger looked back at her. She cleaned the bathroom scrupulously, making sure no hair remained in the shower or on the floor. Extra strands went into the garbage bag, along with the box of hair dye. She wiped the sink and counter down and tied up the garbage bag. Last, she put eye drops in, trying to erase the evidence of her tears. She had to hurry now. She packed her things in a duffel bag. 3 pairs of jeans, 2 sweatshirts, shirts, panties and bras, socks, toothbrush and toothpaste, a brush, mascara for her eyebrows, the little jewelry she owned, cheese and crackers, and nuts and raisins, a fork and a knife. She went to the back porch and dug out the money from beneath the flower pot, the cell phone from the kitchen, and finally, the identification she needed to start a new life, identification she'd stolen from people who trusted her. She'd hated herself for stealing and knew it was wrong, but she'd had no other choice, and she'd prayed to God for forgiveness. It was too late to turn back now. She had rehearsed the scenario in her head 1,000 times, and she moved fast. Most of the neighbors were off at work. She'd watched them in the mornings and knew their routines. She didn't want anyone to see her leave, didn't want anyone to recognize her. She threw on a hat and her jacket, along with a scarf and gloves. She rounded the duffel bag and stuffed it beneath her sweatshirt, kneading and working it until it was round, until she looked pregnant. She put on her long coat, one that was roomy enough to cover the bump. She stared at herself in the mirror. Short, dark hair, skin the color of copper. Pregnant. She put on a pair of sunglasses, and on her way out the door, She turned on her cell phone and set the landline on call forwarding. She left the house through the gate at the side. She walked between her house and the neighbor's, following the fence line, and deposited the garbage bag in their garbage can. She knew that both of them worked, that neither was at home. Same thing for the house behind hers. She walked through their yard and past the side of the house, finally emerging onto the icy sidewalk. Snow had begun to fall again. By tomorrow, she knew, her footprints would be gone. She had 6 blocks to go, but she was going to make it. She kept her head down and walked, trying to ignore the biting wind, feeling dazed and free and terrified, all at the same time. Tomorrow night, she knew, Kevin would walk through the house calling for her, and he wouldn't find her because she wasn't there. And tomorrow night, he would begin his hunt. Snow flurries swirled as Katie stood at the intersection, just outside a diner. In the distance, she saw Super Shuttle's blue van round the corner, and her heart pounded in her chest. Just then, she heard the cell phone ring. She paled. Cars roared past her, their tires loud as they rolled through the slush. In the distance, the van changed lanes, angling toward her side of the road. She had to answer. There was no choice but to answer. But the van was coming, and it was noisy on the street. If she answered now, he would know she was outside. He would know she'd left him. Her phone rang a third time. The blue van stopped at a red light, 1 block away. She turned around, walking into the diner, the sounds muffled but still noticeable. A symphony of plates clanking and people talking. Directly ahead was the hostess stand, where a man was asking for a table. She felt sick to her stomach. She cupped the phone and faced the window, praying that he couldn't hear the commotion behind her. Her legs went wobbly as she pressed the button and answered.
"What took you so long to answer?" he demanded.
"I was in the shower," she said. "What's going on?"
"I'm about 10 minutes out," he said. "How are you?"
"I'm okay," she said. He hesitated.
"You sound kind of funny," he said. "Something wrong with the phone?"
Up the street, the signal light turned green. The Super Shuttle van's turn signal indicated that it was pulling over. She prayed that it would wait. Behind her, people in the diner had gone surprisingly quiet.
"I'm not sure, but you sound fine," she said.
"It's probably bad service where you are. How's the drive?"
"Not too bad once I got out of the city, but it's still icy in places."
"That doesn't sound good. Be careful."
"I'm fine," he said.
"I know," she said. The van was pulling over to the curb, the driver craning his neck, looking for her. "I hate to do this, but can you call me in a few minutes? I still have conditioner in my hair and I want to rinse it out."
"Yeah," he grumbled. "Okay, I'll call you in a bit."
"I love you," she said.
"Love you too."
She let him hang up before she pressed the button on her phone. Then she walked out of the diner and hurried to the van. At the bus terminal, she bought a ticket to Philadelphia, hating the way the man who sold her the ticket kept trying to talk to her. Rather than waiting at the terminal, she went across the street to have breakfast. Money for the shuttle and the bus ticket had taken more than half of the savings she'd collected during the year, but she was hungry, and she ordered pancakes and sausage and milk. At the booth, someone had left a newspaper, and she forced herself to read it. Kevin called her while she was eating, and when he told her again that the phone sounded funny, she suggested that it was the storm. 20 minutes later, she got on the bus. An elderly woman motioned to her bulge as she moved down the aisle.
"How much longer?"
the woman asked. "Another month."
"First one?"
"Yes," she answered, but her mouth was so dry it was hard to keep talking. She started down the aisle again and took a seat toward the rear. People sat in the seats in front of and behind her. Across the aisle was a young couple, teenagers, draped over each other, both of them listening to music, their heads bobbed up and down. She stared out the window as the bus pulled away from the station, feeling as if she were dreaming. On the highway, Boston began to recede into the distance, gray and cold. Her lower back ached as the bus rolled forward, miles from home. Snow continued to fall, and cars whipped up slush as they passed the bus. She wished she could talk to someone. She wanted to tell them that she was running away because her husband beat her, and that she couldn't call the police because he was the police. She wanted to tell them that she didn't have much money, and she could never use her real name again. If she did, he would find her and bring her home and beat her again. Only this time he might not stop. She wanted to tell them that she was terrified, because she didn't know where she was going to sleep tonight, or how she was going to eat when the money ran out. She could feel cold air against the window as towns drifted past. Traffic on the highway thinned, and then the roads became crowded again. She didn't know what she was going to do. All her plans had stopped at the bus, and there was no one to call for help. She was alone, and had nothing but the things she carried with her. An hour from Philadelphia, her cell phone rang again. She cupped the phone and talked to him. Before he hung up, he promised to call her before he went to bed. She arrived in Philadelphia in the late afternoon. It was cold, but not snowy. Passengers got off the bus, and she hung back, waiting for all of them to leave. In the restroom, she removed the duffel bag and then went into the waiting room and took a seat on a bench. Her stomach was growling, and she sliced off a little cheese and ate it with crackers. She knew she had to make it last, though, so she put the rest of it away, even though she was still hungry. Finally, after buying a map of the city, she stepped outside. The terminal wasn't located in a bad part of town. She saw the convention center and Trocadero Theater, which made her feel safe. But it also meant she could never afford a hotel room in the area. The map indicated that she was close to Chinatown, and for lack of a better plan, she headed in that direction. 3 hours later, she'd finally found a place to sleep. It was dingy and reeked of smoke, and her room was barely large enough for the small bed that had been crammed inside. There was no lamp. Instead, a single bulb protruded from the ceiling, and the communal bathroom was down the hall. The walls were gray and water-stained, and the window had bars. From the rooms on either side of her, she could hear people talking in a language she couldn't understand. Still, it was all she could afford. She had enough money to stay 3 nights. 4 if she could somehow survive on the little food she'd brought from home. She sat on the edge of the bed, trembling, afraid of this place, afraid of the future, her mind whirling. She had to pee, but she didn't want to leave the room. She tried to tell herself that it was an adventure and everything would be okay. As crazy as it sounded, she found herself wondering if she'd made a mistake by leaving. She tried not to think about her kitchen and bedroom and all the things she'd left behind. She knew she could buy a ticket back to Boston and get home before Kevin even realized she was gone. But her hair was short and dark, and there was no way she could explain that. Outside, the sun was down, but streetlights shone through the dirty window. She heard horns honking, and she looked out. At the street level, all the signs were in Chinese, and some businesses were still open. She could hear conversations rising in the darkness, and there were plastic bags filled with garbage piled near the street. She was in an unfamiliar city, a city filled with strangers. She couldn't do this, she thought. She wasn't strong enough. In 3 days, she'd have no place to stay unless she could find a job. If she sold her jewelry, she might buy herself another day, but then what? She was so tired, and her back throbbed. She lay down on the bed and drifted off to sleep almost immediately. Kevin called later, the bleating of the cell phone waking her up. It took everything she had to keep her voice steady, to betray nothing, but she sounded as tired as she felt, and she knew that Kevin believed that she was in their bed. When she hung up, she fell asleep again within minutes. In the morning, she could hear people walking down the hall, heading for the bathroom. Two Chinese women stood at the sinks, and there was green mold in the grout and wet toilet paper on the floor. The door to the stall wouldn't lock, and she had to hold it closed with her hand. In the room, she had cheese and crackers for breakfast. She wanted to shower, but she realized she'd forgotten to pack shampoo and soap, so there wasn't much point. She changed her clothes and brushed her teeth and hair. She repacked the duffel bag, unwilling to leave it in the room while she wasn't there, and slung the strap over her shoulder and walked down the steps. The same clerk who'd given her the key was at the desk, and she wondered whether he ever left this place. She paid for another night and asked him to hold her room. Outside, the sky was blue and the streets were dry. She realized the pain in her back had all but vanished. It was cold, but not as cold as Boston. And despite her fears, she found herself smiling. She'd done it, she reminded herself. She'd escaped, and Kevin was hundreds of miles away and didn't know where she was, didn't even know she'd left yet. He would call a couple more times, then she'd throw away the cell phone and never speak with him again. She stood straighter and breathed in the crisp air. The day felt almost new, with endless possibilities. Today, she told herself, she was going to find a job. Today, she decided, she was going to start living the rest of her life. She had run away twice before, and she wanted to think she'd learned from her mistakes. The first time was a little less than a year after she was married, after he'd beaten her while she was cowering in the corner of the bedroom. The bills had come in, and he was angry with her because she'd turned up the thermostat to make the house warmer. When he'd finally stopped, he'd grabbed his keys and headed out to buy more liquor. Without thinking, she'd grabbed her jacket and left the house, limping down the road. Hours later, with sleet coming down and nowhere to go, she'd called him, and he went to pick her up. The next time, she'd gotten as far as Atlantic City before he found her. She'd taken money from his wallet and purchased a ticket on the bus, but he'd found her within an hour of her arrival. He'd driven his car at breakneck speed, knowing she would run to the only place where she might still find friends. He'd handcuffed her in the back seat of the car on the drive back. He stopped once, pulling the car over to the side of a closed office building, and beat her. Later that night, the gun came out. After that, he'd made it harder to leave. He usually kept the money locked away and started tracking her whereabouts obsessively. She knew that he would go to extraordinary lengths to find her. As crazy as he was persistent and diligent, and his instincts were usually right. He would find out where she'd gone, she knew. He would come to Philadelphia to find her. She had a head start, that was all. But with no extra money to start over somewhere else, all she could do was watch for him over her shoulder for the time being. Her time in Philadelphia was limited. She found a job as a cocktail waitress on her third day in town. She made up a name and social security number. Eventually, it would be checked, but she'd be long gone by then. She found another room to rent on the far side of Chinatown. She worked for 2 weeks, accumulated some tip money while searching for and finding another job, and quit without bothering to pick up her paycheck. There was no point. Without identification, she wouldn't be able to cash it. She worked another 3 weeks at a small diner and eventually moved out of Chinatown to a run-down motel that rented by the week. Although it was in a seedier section of town, the room was more expensive. But she had her own shower and bathroom, and it was worth it, if only to have some privacy and a place to leave her things. She saved a few $100s, more than she had when she'd left Dorchester, but not enough to start over. Again, she left before picking up her paycheck, without even going back to quit. She found yet another job at yet another diner a few days later. In the new job, she told the manager her name was Erica. The constant job changing and moves had kept her vigilant, and it was there, only 4 days after she started, that she'd rounded the corner on her way to work and saw a car that seemed somehow out of place. She stopped. Even now, she wasn't sure how she'd realized it, other than the fact that it was shiny enough to reflect the early morning light. As she stared at the car, she noticed movement in the driver's seat. The engine wasn't running, and it struck her as odd that someone would be sitting in an unheated car on a cold morning. The only people, she knew, who did that were those who were waiting for someone. Or watching for someone. Kevin. She knew it was him. Knew it with a certainty that surprised her, and she backed around the corner, the way she'd come, praying that he hadn't glanced in the rearview mirror, praying he hadn't seen her. As soon as the car was out of sight, she began to run back toward the motel, her heart hammering. She hadn't run so fast in years, but all the walking she'd been doing had strengthened her legs, and she moved quickly. One block, two, three. She looked constantly over her shoulder, but Kevin didn't follow. No matter. He knew she was here. He knew where she worked. He would know if she didn't show up. Within hours, he would find out where she was staying. In her room, she threw her things into the duffel bag and was out the door within minutes. She started toward the bus station. It would take forever, though. An hour, maybe more, to walk there, and she didn't have the time. That would be the first place he went when he realized she wasn't there. Turning around, she went back into the motel and had the clerk call her a cab. It arrived 10 minutes later. The longest 10 minutes of her life. At the bus station, she frantically searched the schedule and selected a bus to New York. It was scheduled to leave in half an hour. She hid in the women's restroom until it was time to board. When she got on the bus, she lowered herself into a seat. It didn't take long to get to New York. Again, she scanned the schedules and bought a ticket that would take her as far as Omaha. In the evening, she got off the bus somewhere in Ohio. She slept in the station, and the next morning she found her way to a truck stop. There she met a man who was delivering materials to Wilmington, North Carolina. A few days later, after selling her jewelry, she wandered into Southport and found the cottage. After she paid the first month's rent, there was no money left to buy food. Chapter 23. It was mid-June, and Katie was leaving Ivan's after finishing up a busy dinner shift when she spotted a familiar figure standing near the exit.
Hey there!
Joe waved from beneath the lamppost where Katie had locked up her bike.
What are you doing here?
Katie asked, leaning in to give her friend a hug. She'd never run into Joe in town before, and seeing her out of context felt strange for some reason.
I came to see you. Where have you been, stranger?
I could ask you the same question.
I've been around enough to know you've been seeing Alex for a few weeks.
Joe winked.
But as a friend, I've never been one to impose. I figured you two needed some time alone.
Katie blushed despite herself. How did you know I was here?
I didn't, but your lights weren't on at the house, and I took a chance.
Joe shrugged. She motioned over her shoulder.
Are you doing anything? Do you want to grab a drink before you head home?
When she saw Katie's hesitation, she went on.
I know it's late. One drink, I promise. Then I'll let you go to bed.
One drink, Katie agreed. A few minutes later, they stepped inside the pub, a local favorite paneled in dark wood scarred with decades of use, with a long mirror behind the bar. It was quiet tonight. Only a few tables were occupied, and the two women took a seat at a corner table in the back. Since there didn't seem to be table service, Katie ordered 2 glasses of wine at the bar and brought them back to the table.
Thanks, Joe said, taking her glass. Next time it's on me.
She leaned back.
So, you and Alex, huh?
Is that really what you wanted to talk to me about? Katie asked.
Well, since my own love life is in the dumps, I have to live vicariously through you. It seems to be going well, though. He was over there, what, 2 or 3 times last week? And the same thing the week before that?
Actually, more, Katie thought.
Something like that.
Joe twisted the stem of her wine glass.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh what?
If I didn't know better, I'd think it was getting serious.
She raised an eyebrow. We're still getting to know each other, Katie offered, not sure where Joe was going with this line of questioning.
That's how every relationship starts. He likes you, you like him. Then you both go from there.
Is this why you came down? Katie tried not to sound exasperated. To hear all the details?
Not all of them. Just the juicy ones.
Katie rolled her eyes. How about we talk about your love life instead?
Why? Are you in the mood to be depressed?
When was the last time you went on a date?
A good date or just a date?
A good date. Joe hesitated.
I'd have to say that it's been at least a couple of years.
What happened? Joe dipped a finger in her wine, then ran it around the rim of her glass, making it hum. Finally, she looked up. A good man is hard to find, she said, wistfully. Not everyone is as lucky as you are. Katie didn't know quite how to respond to that, so instead, she touched Joe's hand. What's really going on? She asked gently. Why did you want to talk to me? Joe looked around the empty bar as if trying to draw inspiration from her surroundings. Do you ever sit back and wonder what it all means? Whether this is it, or if there's something greater out there? Or if you were meant for something better? I think everyone does, Katie answered, her curiosity growing. When I was a girl, I used to make believe that I was a princess. One of the good ones, I mean. Someone who always does the right thing and has the power to make people's lives better so that in the end, they live happily ever after. Katie nodded. She could remember doing the same thing, but she still wasn't sure where Joe was going, so she stayed quiet. I think that's why I do what I do now. When I started, I just wanted to help. I'd see people who were struggling with the loss of someone they loved, a parent, a child, a friend, and my heart just overflowed with sympathy. I tried to do everything in my power to make things better for them. But as time passed, I came to realize that there was only so much I could do myself. That in the end, people who are grieving have to want to move on. That first step, that motivating spark, has to come from within them. And when it does, it opens the door to the unexpected. Katie took a deep breath, trying to make sense of Joe's rambling. I don't know what you're trying to tell me. Joe swirled her wine, studying the little whirlpool in her glass. For the first time, her tone became utterly serious. I'm talking about you and Alex. Katie couldn't hide her surprise. Me and Alex? Yes, she nodded. He's told you about losing his wife, right? About how hard it was for him, for the whole family, to get past it. Katie stared across the table, suddenly uncomfortable. Yes, she began. Then be careful with them, Joe said, her tone serious. All of them. Don't break their hearts. In the awkward silence that followed, Katie found herself recalling their first conversation about Alex. Did you two ever see each other? She remembered asking Joe. Yes, but maybe not in the way you're thinking, Joe had answered. And just so we're clear, it was a long time ago and everyone has moved on. At the time, she'd assumed that it meant that Joe and Alex had dated in the past, but now she was struck by the obviousness of the conclusion. The counselor Alex had mentioned, who had seen the kids and consulted with him in the aftermath of Carly's death, it must have been Joe.
Katie sat up straight. You worked with Alex and the kids, didn't you? After Carly died, I mean.
I'd rather not say, Joe answered. Her tone was measured and calm, just like a counselor's.
I can say that all of them mean a lot to me. And if you're not serious about a possible future with them, I think you should end it now, before it's too late.
Katie felt her cheeks flush. It seemed inappropriate, presumptuous even, for Joe to be talking to her like this.
I'm not sure any of this is really your concern, she said, her voice tight.
Joe acknowledged her point with a reluctant nod.
You're right. It's not my concern. And I'm crossing some important boundaries here. But I really do think they've been through enough. And the last thing I want for them is to become attached to someone who has no intention of staying in Southport. Maybe I'm worried that the past is never really in the past, and that you might decide to leave, no matter how much sadness you leave in your wake.
Katie was speechless. This conversation was so unexpected, so uncomfortable, and Joe's words had definitely thrown her emotions into turmoil. If Joe sensed Katie's discomfort, she pressed on anyway.
Love doesn't mean anything if you're not willing to make a commitment, she said. And you have to think not only about what you want, but about what he wants. Not just now, but in the future.
She continued to stare at Katie across the table, her brown eyes unwavering.
Are you ready to be a wife to Alex and a mother to his kids? Because that's what Alex wants. Maybe not right now, but he will in the future. And if you're not willing to make a commitment, if you're only going to toy with his feelings and those of his children, then you're not the person he needs in his life.
Before Katie could say anything, Joe got up from the table as she went on. It might have been wrong for me to say all this, and maybe we won't be friends any longer, but I wouldn't feel right about myself if I didn't speak plainly. As I've said from the very beginning, he's a good man, a rare man. He loves deeply and never stops loving. She let those words sink in before her expression suddenly softened.
I think you're the same way, but I wanted to remind you that if you care about him, then you have to be willing to commit to him, no matter what the future might bring, no matter how scared you might be.
With that, she turned and left the bar, leaving Katie sitting at the table in stunned silence. It was only as she got up to leave that she noticed that Joe hadn't touched her wine. Chapter 24. Kevin Tierney didn't go to Provincetown on the weekend he'd told Coffey and Ramirez that he would. Instead, he stayed home with the curtains closed, brooding over how close he'd come to finding her in Philadelphia. He wouldn't have succeeded in tracking her that far, except that she'd made a mistake in going to the bus station. He knew it was the only transportation choice she could have made. Tickets were cheap, and identification wasn't necessary. And though he wasn't sure how much she'd stolen from him, he knew it couldn't have been much. From the first day they were married, he'd controlled the money. He always made her keep receipts and give him any change. But after she'd run away the second time, he'd also started locking his wallet in the gun box with his guns when he went to sleep. Sometimes, though, he fell asleep on the couch, and he imagined her slipping the wallet from his pocket and stealing his money. He imagined the way she silently laughed at him as she did it, and how in the morning she would make him breakfast and pretend that she'd done nothing wrong. She would smile and kiss him, but inside she was laughing at him. She'd stolen from him, and he knew that was wrong because the Bible says, "Thou shalt not steal." In the darkness, he chewed his lips, remembering his initial hope that she might come back. It was snowing, and she couldn't get far. The first time she'd run away, it had also been on a bitter cold night, and she'd called him within a few hours and asked him to pick her up because she had nowhere else to go. When she got home, she apologized for what she'd done, and he made her a cup of hot cocoa as she sat shivering on the couch. He brought her a blanket and watched as she covered herself, trying to get warm. She smiled at him, and he smiled at her, but once she stopped shivering, he crossed the room and slapped her until she cried. By the time he rose for work in the morning, she'd cleaned the spilled cocoa from the floor, though there was still a stain on the rug that she couldn't get out, and sometimes the sight of it made him angry. On the night he realized she was missing last January, he drank 2 glasses of vodka while he waited for her to come back, but the phone didn't ring, and the front door stayed closed. He knew she hadn't been gone long. He'd spoken to her less than an hour before, and she'd told him she was making dinner. But there was no dinner on the stove, no sign of her in the house or in the cellar or in the garage. He stood on the porch and looked for footprints in the snow, but it was obvious that she hadn't left through the front door. But the snow in the backyard was equally pristine, so she hadn't left that way either. It was as if she'd floated away or vanished into thin air, which meant she had to be here, except that she wasn't. 2 more vodkas later, and another half hour passed. By then he was in a rage, and he punched a hole in the bedroom door. He stormed from the house and banged on the neighbors' doors, asking if they'd noticed her leaving, but none of them could tell him anything. He hopped in his car and drove up and down the streets of the neighborhood, looking for traces of her, trying to figure out how she'd been able to leave the house without leaving any clues behind. By then, he figured she had a 2-hour head start, but she was walking, and in this weather she couldn't have gotten far. Unless someone had come to pick her up. Someone she cared about. A man. He pounded the wheel, his face contorted in fury. 6 blocks away was the commercial district. He went to the businesses there, flashing a wallet-sized photograph and asking if anyone had seen her. No one had. He told them she might have been with a man, and still they shook their heads. The men he asked were adamant about it. "A pretty blonde like that," they said. "I would have noticed her, especially on a night like tonight." He drove each and every road within 5 miles of the house 2 or 3 times before finally going back home. It was 3 a.m. and the house was empty. After another vodka, he cried himself to sleep. In the morning, when he woke, he was enraged again, and with a hammer he smashed the flower pots she kept in the backyard. Breathing hard, he went to the phone and called in sick, then went to the couch and tried to figure out how she'd gotten away. Someone had to have picked her up. Someone must have driven her someplace. Someone she knew. A friend from Atlantic City? Altoona? Possible, he supposed, except that he checked the phone bills every month. She never placed long-distance phone calls. Someone local, then. But who? She never went anywhere, never talked to anyone. He made sure of that. He went to the kitchen and was pouring himself another drink when he heard the phone ring. He lunged for it, hoping it was Aaron. Strangely, however, the phone rang only once, and when he picked up, he heard a dial tone. He stared at the receiver, trying to figure it out before hanging up the phone. How had she gotten away? He was missing something. Even if someone local had picked her up, how had she gotten to the road without leaving footprints? He stared out the window, trying to piece together the sequence of events. Something seemed off, though he couldn't identify what it was. He turned away from the window and found himself focused on the telephone. It was then that the pieces suddenly came together, and he pulled out his cell phone. He dialed his home number and listened as it rang once. The cell phone kept ringing. When he picked up the landline, he heard a dial tone and realized that she'd forwarded the calls to a cell phone, which meant she hadn't been here when he'd called her last night. which also explained the bad reception he'd noticed over the past 2 days. And, of course, the lack of footprints in the snow. She'd been gone, he now knew, since Tuesday morning. At the bus station, she made a mistake, even if she couldn't really help it. She should have purchased her tickets from a woman, since Aaron was pretty and men always remembered pretty women. It didn't matter whether their hair was long and blonde or short and dark, nor did it matter if she pretended she was pregnant. He went to the bus station. He showed his badge and carried a larger photograph of her. The first 2 times he visited, none of the ticket sellers had recognized her. The third time, though, one of them hesitated and said that it might have been her, except that her hair was short and brown and that she was pregnant. He didn't, however, remember her destination. Back at home, Kevin found a photograph of her on the computer and used Photoshop to change her hair from blonde to brown and then shortened it. He called in sick again on Friday. "That's her," the ticket seller confirmed, and Kevin felt a surge of energy. She thought she was smarter than he was, but she was stupid and careless, and she'd made a mistake. He took a couple of vacation days the following week and continued to hang around the bus station, showing the new photograph to drivers. He arrived in the morning and left late, since the drivers came and went all day long. There were 2 bottles in the car, and he poured the vodka into a styrofoam cup and sipped it with a straw. On Saturday, 11 days after she'd left him, he found the driver. The driver had taken her to Philadelphia. "He remembered her," he said, "because she was pretty and pregnant, and she didn't have any luggage." Philadelphia. She might have left again from there to parts unknown, but it was the only lead he had. Plus, he knew she didn't have much money. He'd packed a bag and hopped in his car and drove to Philadelphia. He parked at the bus station and tried to think like her. He was a good detective, and he knew that if he could think like her, he'd be able to find her. People, he'd learned, were predictable. The bus had arrived a few minutes before 4 o'clock, and he stood in the bus station, looking from one direction to the next. She had stood here days earlier, he thought, and he wondered what she would do in a strange city with no money and no friends and no place to go. Quarters and dimes and dollar bills wouldn't go far, especially after purchasing a bus ticket. It was cold, he remembered, and it would have been getting dark soon. She wouldn't want to walk far, and she would need a place to stay. A place that took cash. But where? Not here, in this area. Too expensive. Where would she go? She wouldn't want to get lost or head in the wrong direction, which meant that she probably looked in the phone book. He went back inside the terminal and looked under hotels. Pages and pages, he realized. She might have picked one, but then what? She'd have to walk there, which meant she'd need a map. He went to the convenience store at the station and bought himself a map. He showed the clerk the photograph, but he shook his head. He hadn't been working on Tuesday, he said, but it felt right to Kevin. This, he knew, was what she did. He unfolded the map and located the station. It bordered on Chinatown, and he guessed she had headed in that direction. He got in his car and drove the streets of Chinatown, and again, it felt right. He drank his vodka and walked the streets. He started at those businesses closest to the bus station and showed her picture around. No one knew anything, but he had the sense that some of them were lying. He found cheap rooms, places he never would have taken her, dirty places with dirty sheets, managed by men who spoke little English and took only cash. He implied that she was in danger if he couldn't find her. He found the first place she'd stayed, but the owner didn't know where she'd gone after that. Kevin put a gun to the man's head, but even though he cried, he couldn't tell Kevin anything more. Kevin had to go back to work on Monday, furious that she'd eluded him. But the following weekend, he was back in Philadelphia. and the weekend after that. He expanded his search, but the problem was that there were too many places, and he was only one person, and not everyone trusted an out-of-town cop. But he was patient and diligent, and he kept coming back and took more vacation days. Another weekend passed. He widened his search, knowing she would need cash. He stopped in bars and restaurants and diners. He would check everyone in the city if he had to. Finally, a week after Valentine's Day, he met a waitress named Tracy, who told him that Erin was working at a diner, except she was calling herself Erica. She was scheduled to work the following day. The waitress trusted him, because he was a detective, and she'd even flirted with him, handing him her phone number before he left. He rented a car and waited up the block from the diner the following morning, before the sun was up. Employees entered through a door in the alley. He sipped from his styrofoam cup in the front seat, watching for her. Eventually, he saw the owner and Tracy and another woman head down the alley, but Erin never showed, and she didn't show up the following day, either, and no one knew where she lived. She never came back to pick up her paycheck. He found where she lived a few hours later. It was walking distance from the diner, a piece of crap hotel. The man, who accepted only cash, knew nothing except that Erin had left the day before and come back and left again in a hurry. Kevin searched her room, but there was nothing inside, and when he finally raced to the bus station, there were only women in the ticket booths, and none of them remembered her. Buses in the last 2 hours were traveling north, south, east, and west, going everywhere. She'd disappeared again. And in the car, Kevin screamed and beat his fists against the wheel until they were bruised and swollen. In the months that Erin had been gone, he felt the ache inside grow more poisonous and all-consuming, spreading like a cancer every day. He had returned to Philadelphia and questioned the drivers over the next few weeks, but it hadn't amounted to much. He eventually learned that she'd gone on to New York, but from there, the trail went cold. Too many buses, too many drivers, too many passengers. Too many days had passed since then. Too many options. She could be anywhere, and the thought that she was gone tormented him. He flew into rages and broke things. He cried himself to sleep. He was filled with despair and sometimes felt like he was losing his mind. It wasn't fair. He'd loved her since the first time they met in Atlantic City. And they'd been happy, hadn't they? Early on in the marriage, she used to sing to herself as she put on her makeup. He used to bring her to the library, and she would check out 8 or 10 books. Sometimes she would read him passages, and he would hear her voice and watch the way she leaned against the counter and think to himself that she was the most beautiful woman in the world. He'd been a good husband. He bought her the house she wanted, and the curtains she wanted, and the furniture she wanted, even though he could barely afford it. After they were married, he often bought flowers from street vendors on the way home, and Erin would put them in a vase on the table, along with candles, and the two of them would have romantic dinners. Sometimes they ended up making love in the kitchen, her back pressed against the counter. He never made her work, either, and she didn't know how good she had it. She didn't understand the sacrifices he made for her. She was spoiled and selfish, and it used to make him so angry because she didn't understand how easy her life was. Clean the house and make a meal, and she could spend the rest of her days reading stupid books she checked out from the library and watching television and taking naps and never having to worry about a utility bill or mortgage payment or people who talked about him behind his back. She never had to see the faces of people who had been murdered. He kept that from her, because he loved her, but it had made no difference. He never told her about the children who'd been burned with irons or tossed from the roofs of buildings, or women stabbed in the alley and thrown in dumpsters. He never told her that sometimes he had to scrape the blood from his shoes before he got in the car, and when he looked into the eyes of murderers, he knew he was coming face to face with evil. Because the Bible says, To kill a person is to kill a living being made in God's image. He loved her, and she loved him, and she had to come home because he couldn't find her. She could have her happy life again, and he wouldn't hit or punch or slap or kick her if she walked in the door, because he'd always been a good husband. He loved her, and she loved him, and he remembered that on the day he asked her to marry him, she reminded him of the night they'd met outside the casino when the men were following her. Dangerous men. He'd stopped them from hurting her that night, and in the morning they'd walked along the boardwalk, and he took her for coffee. She told him that of course she would marry him. She loved him, she said. He made her feel safe. Safe. That was the word she used. Safe. Chapter 25. The third week of June was a series of glorious high summer days. The temperature crept up over the course of the afternoon, bringing with it humidity heavy enough to thicken the air and blur the horizon. Heavy clouds would then form, as if by magic, and violent thunderstorms would drop torrents of rain. The showers never lasted long, though, leaving behind only dripping leaves and a layer of ground mist. Katie continued to work long evening shifts at the restaurant. She was tired when she rode home, and in the morning, her legs and feet often ached. She put half the money she earned in tips in the coffee can, and it was almost filled to the brim. She had more money than she'd imagined she'd be able to save, more than enough to get away if she had to. For the first time, she wondered whether she needed to add more. Lingering over her last few bites of breakfast, she stared out the window at Joe's house. She hadn't spoken with her since their encounter, and last night, after her shift, she'd seen lights burning in Joe's kitchen and living room. Earlier this morning, she'd heard her car start up and listened to the crunching of dirt and gravel as it pulled away. She didn't know what to say to Joe, or even whether she wanted to say anything at all. She couldn't even decide whether she was angry with her. Joe cared about Alex and the kids. She was worried about them and had expressed her concerns to Katie. It was hard to find malice in anything she'd done. Alex, she knew, would be by later today. His visits had settled into something of a routine, and when they were together, she was constantly reminded of all the reasons she'd fallen for him in the first place. He accepted her occasional silences and varying moods, and he treated her with a gentleness that astonished and touched her. But since her conversation with Joe, she wondered if she was being unfair to him. What would happen, after all, if Kevin showed up? How would Alex and the kids react if she disappeared, never to return? Was she willing to leave all of them behind and never talk to them again? She hated the questions Joe had raised, because she wasn't ready to face them. "You have no idea what I've been through," she wanted to say afterward, once she had time to think about it. "You have no idea what my husband is like." But even she knew that begged the question. Leaving her breakfast dishes in the sink, she walked through the small cottage, thinking how much had changed in the last few months. She owned virtually nothing, but felt like she had more than ever. She felt loved for the first time in years. She'd never been a parent, but she found herself thinking and worrying about Kristen and Josh when she least expected it. She knew she couldn't predict the future, and yet she was struck with the sudden certainty that leaving this new existence behind was inconceivable. What had Joe once said to her? "I just tell people what they already know, but are afraid to admit to themselves." Reflecting on her words, she knew exactly what she had to do. "Sure," Alex said to her after she related her request. She could tell he was surprised, but he also seemed encouraged.
"When do you want to start?"
"How about today?" she suggested, if you have any time. He looked around the store. There was only one person eating in the grill area, and Roger was leaning against the counter, chatting with him.
Hey, Roger, do you think you could watch the register for an hour?
No problem, boss,
Roger said. He stayed where he was. Alex knew he wouldn't come up front unless necessary. But on a weekday morning, after the initial rush, he didn't expect many people in the store, so Alex didn't mind. He moved out from behind the register.
You ready?
Not really. She hugged herself nervously. But it's something I should know how to do. They left the store, walking toward his Jeep. Climbing in, she could feel his gaze on her.
Why the sudden rush to learn how to drive? He asked. Is the bike not good enough?
He teased. The bike is all I need, she said. But I want to get a driver's license. He reached for the car keys before pausing. He turned back to her again, and as he stared at her, she caught a glimpse of the investigator he used to be. He was alert, and she sensed his caution.
Learning how to drive is only part of it. To get a license, the state requires identification, birth certificate, social security card, things like that.
I know,